and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. Standing in for Andrew Tuck this week, I'm Carlotta Ribello. Coming up on the program.
I think that it's ultimately a platform for us to come together, for us to redefine what it means to operate within a community, to be there for each other and support each other. But I also really believe that through this, we also can affect a lot of change and a lot of positive impact.
We continue to unpack our brand new book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities. This week, we turn our focus to Chapter 7, looking at the places where we work. At a time when so many people can run their businesses from a laptop and a mobile phone, do you really need an office? From setting up shop in your corner cafe or hotel lobby to co-working spaces, the nature of work in a city has changed dramatically over the past couple of years. Plus, is there still space for the good old big company HQ? We'll find out. That's all coming up right now on The Urbanist with me, Carlotta Ribello. To get us started, we delve into the world of the shared space devotees. Yes, co-working. A trend that has grown so fast over the past couple of decades that today it would be unthinkable not to have one of these spaces in any major city. But are they the way of the future? One company that has been a genuine pioneer in the field is WeWork. Founded 8 years ago, WeWork has paved the way to move co-working from just a mash of grim cubicles to a broader sense of community, with some big-name companies adopting it too. Lenny Snymer is the general manager for WeWork in the UK and Ireland, and she joined me a little earlier to talk about the company and why they believe co-working is the way forward.
WeWork is a global network of workspaces. So we transform buildings into beautiful, dynamic, collaborative communities that allow people and companies to grow together. So we have 287 locations around the world in 77 cities. And there are different memberships comprising of entrepreneurs, startups, social impact companies, enterprise companies. And it's a place and a space for people to really be able to connect to something bigger than themselves and be a part of the future of work.
Now, you mentioned two things there that are quite interesting, not only the membership, but the community. And that seems like that's what drives a lot of people to WeWork, is that idea that you build a community around the place where you work.
Certainly. We believe and we know that there is a macro shift in the way that people are working. And historically, people would go into work, work a 9-to-5 job, and that was essentially a means to be able to get the funds that they needed to live the life they actually wanted to live. And there's been a huge shift in people wanting more out of their work and wanting to actually identify it much more with who they are as a person. But when you start to think about the commitment to that and how much more people are giving to their work, that actually can be rather isolating. And so by bringing people together and humanizing that experience and bringing people together in a workplace, they're able to feel inspired. They're able to connect through our space, our community, and our services in order to not only allow their business to grow more, but to allow them to really grow more as individuals as well.
We've been seeing for the past couple of years a boom in everything that is shared, co-working, co-living. But when it comes to co-working, why do you think there's been this rise? I think if you just look back a mere 5 years ago, it was a new thing coming up to the market. And nowadays, everyone knows what it means.
I think that the rise, this goes back to that real macro shift. I think it's inevitable and very much in our face that people are wanting more. I think with the rise of a more digitally connected world, with the rise of desire of flexibility and travel and pushing boundaries and entrepreneurship and thinking of new things, I think inevitably that's going to reflect in work as well. And so I think what people want out of their work experience, work makes up so much of your life and therefore so much of one's identity. And so this search for something that is inspiring or meaningful or being part of something bigger, it is so intricately connected to the work experience. I truly think that the idea, it's not just co-working, it's why, it's the meaning behind that. And I think if we're able to drive these communities and actually help support these individuals or these companies, whether it is through the actual space and offering them the flexibility that they now require, or whether it's helping to facilitate the connections that will make them more successful or help them feel supported in those ventures. It's a scary path to navigate, I think. And I think we're ultimately supporting them and helping them become a part of a larger network that makes them feel not so alone in that venture.
When people think about co-working, there's an idea on everyone's mind of what is the target demographic that likes these co-working environments. And usually it's a younger generation. But that's not exactly the case anymore, is it?
No, it's really not. And I think what we've discovered, I think initially earlier when WeWork was first starting, certainly we had a lot of entrepreneurs, we had a lot of startups in our spaces, but due to this larger shift of work in general, we started to see the larger enterprises coming in and saying, wait, we actually want to be around these innovative young companies, and there's something to learn. We want to innovate. We want to be in the space. And so especially with the rise of our larger enterprises joining the WeWork community, you see a huge range of every kind of diversity possible, and age is certainly one of those. I think we call ourselves the We Generation. We think of this kind of concept of being collective and together, and that's not restricted by what age you are, but we are rather much more focused on the desire to want to be together and the desire to want to be a part of the movement to shape what the future of work really means.
You mentioned earlier about how WeWork in cities has changed. No longer that idea of a 9-to-5 job for the rest of your life in the same office. That has changed a lot. So what do you think? Do you think that the way we work now has transformed our cities, or have the way cities are today led to this different way of working?
I love that question. I think it's so closely intertwined. I think we know that the rise of communities and the rise of the shift in work is shaping our cities. I think not only is it creating more jobs, not only is it changing the way that people are actually utilizing space in a city and wanting to get more and different things out of their cities, but I think it's, of course, incredibly interlinked. The other thing that we're working on is something called Powered by We, which is an opportunity for us to actually go into a already leased space and be able to support and bring that culture and that environment to an already leased building if a company wants the kind of energy and culture that we're able to provide. So whether it is doing that or whether it's being more aware of flexible hours or remote working, ultimately it's that people want to find purpose in what they do. And of course, that is going to change how they interact with their city because they're wanting to find so much more out of it.
And perhaps just finally, going back to WeWork, the company, and where you see yourself going forward in the next couple of years.
I would say the opportunities are endless. I think we truly believe it's not just about the actual physical product that we have. We genuinely believe that if we all work together for the good of our communities, member communities and the communities in which we live and work, the cities that you mentioned, that we can actually be a powerful force for good in the world. And so I think that it's ultimately a platform for us to come together, for us to redefine what it means to operate within a community, to be there for each other and support each other. But I also really believe that through this, we also can affect a lot of change and a lot of positive impact to come.
That was Lenny Snymer, who's the general manager for WeWork in the UK and Ireland. Now, while business districts filled with offices may not disappear entirely, if you can work directly from your laptop, you're way less likely to venture out to a neighbourhood that has very little appeal to it. Cue the nomadic workers. You'll find them at reception areas, cafes, small restaurants, and even hotel lobbies. The city is becoming an office, and these workers are taking advantage of it. One of the favourite hangouts for nomadic workers here in London is the Hoxton Hotel, where among the warm glow of MacBooks, you'll find a small group of them huddled over coffee in the lobby. We decided to try it out and dispatched our own Paige Reynolds to meet with the Hoxton's Alice Tate. But first, she caught up with some of the workers getting ready to open their office for the day.
There are lots of little quiet nooks in which to work, and everyone's super friendly, and I get a lot done here actually.
Really, it's just a great creative space. It's nice and open. It's got good coffee, good juice. And yeah, it's just a good place to think, focus.
It's just like very vibrant, and I get a lot of inspiration from this kind of places, and I can really focus well in here. Some people can't, I know, but for me it's really the noise and everything. It's really nice to work, and I love it.
Despite the fact that it's just a hotel lobby, there's quite a nice kind of friendly feel to it. It's also like a degree of anonymity that you can kind of come, make yourself cozy, open up your laptop, and then kind of not be hassled.
This works for me. I can just get on the train and get into London, meet clients. It's a little bit of a less stuffy environment. I used to work in big corporates, and now obviously I'm not, so I think that's a bit of a change in pace.
These cheery nomadic workers were all found tapping away at the Hoxton, an Ennismore hotel based in Shoreditch. With its expansive, plushly furnished lobby and an almost 24/7 conveyor belt of coffee, it's easy to see how the vibe of the Hoxton is a veritable delight for those lucky freelance folk who call this their office. Nestled in a nook just off the main lobby, Alice Tate, European Head of PR for Ennismore, tells me more about how nomadic work culture is a part of their brand.
We do design our spaces definitely with people working in mind, so we're super conscious of having plenty of plugs, and we've got free Wi-Fi, and we pride our open lobby culture is what we communicate. So we definitely do welcome people in. We want people to use our spaces. We don't want it to be just a sea of MacBooks all the time, but I think there's a nice balance between people having coffee, people chatting, eating, working, but we do set up our spaces for people to come and work.
I guess, playing devil's advocate, a lot of people might come in here and not order any coffee or not order any food, but do you think that they still add value to the Hoxton, I guess, as a brand?
I think they definitely add value. I think, of course, there are going to be people who, you know, will stay all day on that first flat white, but it doesn't happen too often, and we really do appreciate people using our lobby and the buzz and everything that it creates, and I think people want to be in a space where there's people, and sometimes I work here all day myself, and it's just interesting to kind of watch people, and they are here all day kind of going through the different stages of their day. It's amazing. But we set up our spaces for that, with the kind of, you can order food from the restaurant to anywhere in the lobby, and that's the same in all of our hotels. So it is that kind of stay all day culture, I think.
And it's quite different, I suppose, to a co-working space where you have to sort of have a membership and it's a lot more regimented. Do you think people appreciate how sort of relaxed it is?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's more that kind of, it doesn't feel exclusive. It's super inclusive, and that's always what we want to be. Our doors are open to everyone, and there's kind of no expectations. It's just a kind of super all-inclusive culture, because you've got everyone from hotel guests to locals to mums with babies and kind of everyone. So you get more of a larger demographic, I think, in here as well, by not being a members club.
And what kind of people do you have in here? Like, do you have regulars, people that come in all the time? Is it sort of people in creative industries? I guess you're in Shoreditch, so there's a lot of creative people around, a lot of people that are freelancing. Can you tell me about some of the people that come in here?
Yeah, of course. I really do think it is a large mix. So our restaurants, people definitely come for meetings and business meetings, or you can tell people are having just kind of creative meetings or from agencies or whatever. Definitely here in Shoreditch, it's a lot more creative types. It's funny, you can sometimes spy people's laptops and I can see they're kind of working on like video editing or editing music. I think it is definitely a creative crowd, but we all mix. And also our crowds in each location and neighbourhood are quite different. Holborn, because it's central, is slightly more businessy, without feeling too businessy, but you can kind of just tell from the clientele. And Paris is a kind of a very fashion-y crowd. The area that we're in, the Sentier, is lots of fashion houses and startups around there. So I definitely think the people who work here, it is quite a young demographic, and startup-y culture is definitely quite rife here in Shoreditch. And I think it's a really nice place to work and soak up the buzz, and freelancer, if you don't want to be at home, it's a really nice place to just maybe spend one of your days a week.
I wonder, have you ever, and perhaps not, but you ever see people that are coming here regularly and they sort of start to have a relationship or like a working relationship? I don't know if that's something that you would be able to spy.
I mean, I think the front desk team would definitely be able to tell you there were some super regulars. I mean, even from, I'm in here a few days a week maybe, and you do see some of the same people who work here all the time. I remember seeing a guy who was honestly here every time I came in. I was kind of felt like I had to start waving at him. And then we have some people who just, you know, we know they work nearby or they run yoga classes nearby, or so they just pop in whether it's for coffee or to work. And I like that it's the same in Paris and Amsterdam. It's really interesting to go and see that that culture that we have created and kind of embraced is replicated there as well.
A report there by Paige Reynolds, and she was speaking to Alice Tate from the Hoxton Hotel Group. This is The Urbanist. Let's take a little break from today's theme to return to some of the essays in our book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities. Today, we put the spotlight on Warsaw. Here's our correspondent, Annabel Chapman.
Communist to capitalist. Warsaw is a city of layers. For a snapshot of its eclecticism, stop by Grzybowski Square near the main train station. Around the perimeter, glassy blue skyscrapers jostle with nondescript blocks of flats built during the communist era, the red brick of pre-war tenement houses, a Renaissance-style church, and the site of the Jewish Theatre, with the city's last functioning regular Orthodox Jewish synagogue behind it. Peeking through a gap in the buildings is the Stalinist Palace of Culture and Science, completed in 1955. The city bears the scars of Poland's history, foreign occupation, wartime devastation, and communist rule. Most of its buildings were destroyed by the Nazis during the Second World War, with swaths of the city razed to the ground. Hundreds of thousands of civilians died, including most of the city's Jewish inhabitants. On the rubble of the Warsaw Ghetto, Poland's new authorities built a ponderous housing estate. A socialist realist housing complex was constructed along the city's main thoroughfare, its facades decorated with relief carvings of the proletariat. And the old town was gradually rebuilt, with planners consulting the Warsaw cityscapes by 18th century Venetian painter Bernardo Bellotto. After the fall of communism in Eastern Europe in 1989, capitalism swept in, bringing fast food chains and sprawling shopping malls. A metro, planned during the 1920s, was finally realized. Skyscrapers sprouted around the Palace of Culture and Science, which continues to spark mixed emotions. Some people see it as an ugly reminder of the communist past, when Poland was subordinate to the Soviet Union. There have been recurring calls to tear it down, but no consensus on what could replace it. The city's new openness is felt most strongly in summer. People get out more. Unlike under communism, when wining and dining options were limited, cafes move out onto the streets as part of what is known as the Mediterranization of city centres. On Zbawiciela Square, bike-toting millennials mingle over drinks, while old market halls and factories have been transformed into mixed-use spaces serving Asian-style street food. The Vistula embankment has had a facelift, complete with a new promenade and riverside dance spots. On the river's wild eastern bank, sandy beaches offer a view of the city, and neon lights attached to one of the bridges spell out Miłocie widzieć, Polish for nice to see you. Challenges remain, including the smog in winter, the result of traffic pollution and Poland's dependence on coal. Hardy cyclists don masks and pedal on. The city centre can feel intense, a hot plateau in summer and a frosty expanse in winter, but refuge can be found in the leafy districts of Mokotów, Żoliborz, Ochota, and Saska Kępa, which retain Warsaw's pre-war charm. These days, their modernist flats built in the 1920s and 1930s house creatives, young families, and old-timers, some of whom remember the city before the war. Praga, on the opposite bank, has a more unpolished feel, with century-old tenement houses built around shady courtyards. Some have gaudy shrines to the Virgin Mary, decked with flowers. Warsaw may lack the historical charm of Poland's second largest city, Kraków, with its preserved medieval centre. But one thing the capital city isn't short of is resilience, through war, the communist years and beyond. From the ashes, it has become a thriving city geared towards the future.
That was Monocle's Warsaw correspondent, Annabel Chapman. You're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24, and this is our show about work and the city. Now, we've talked about nomadic workers and the boom in co-working spaces, but that doesn't mean that a good company HQ no longer has a place in the cities of today. When done right, the headquarters of a big business can be a welcome addition to the city and its community. One such example, it's the HQ of the Parisian advertising agency BETC, called Magasins Généraux. The company relocated from the heart of the city to the suburbs in a bold move to drive change to the area. Eugénie Lefebvre is the director of Magasins Généraux, and she joined me earlier to talk about the building, the community, and why it is still worth building good HQs.
We are a creative agency. BETC, Magasins Généraux, is the name of the building, the new headquarters of BETC. And as a creative agency, we are really attached to be in the center of the city, which is moving, which is actually designing the future of the city. And we really feel, as in a lot of big cities actually in the world, that the East is a territory where creativity and innovation are rising a lot. And it's the same in Paris. So we were born, actually, BETC was born in the western suburb of Paris, in Levallois-Perret, in the west of Paris, where you can find a lot of advertising agencies and a lot of companies, actually. And in the 2000, we moved in the center of Paris, but yet in the eastern center of Paris, in the area of Gare de l'Est, which was a really popular multicultural area in Paris. And it was actually already a big move because it wasn't expected for an agency to be in that kind of area, really popular with a lot of cultures, a lot of traditional shops, etc. But we were already at the time feeling that it was really the future of Paris that was rising there. And then 15 years later, actually, this area of Paris is now really, really trendy. And we wanted to just explore the future of Paris and the future of the greater Paris. So we crossed again the périphérique, which is this circular line around Paris, and moved again in the suburb, but in the eastern suburb, where really creativity, creation and innovation are rising.
Now, it is interesting what you mentioned there about chasing unknown areas in a way and try to bring the best out of them. Now, the Magasins Généraux is by the canal and it kind of has brought new life to the area, hasn't it?
We weren't the first ones, which is important for us, just to recall that there are this big international contemporary art gallery, Thaddeus Ropac, that has moved before us and had started also to bring some creation and artistic direction to this area. But actually, yes, we wanted to be part of that. Actually, what we can call a new laboratory or a new center for this greater Paris. The canal is a really, really interesting path between Paris and the suburb and between Paris and this eastern part of the greater Paris. It's a really natural, fluid continuity between the center of Paris and the suburb. And it really gathers a lot of creativity, a lot of creative actors that want to be part of a big movement in this area. And we are one of the big actors of this movement and this rise of the territory.
Tell me a bit about the building then. How does it look? What sort of infrastructure does it have? I know that on the ground floor you have some sort of businesses there that everyone can access. You don't have to work in the building. Tell us a bit more about it.
The Magasins Généraux, actually, it's the normal name in France to call the warehouses. The Magasins Généraux are kind of warehouses that you can find in a lot of big cities and around big cities. And it was the Magasins Généraux in Pantin was a former warehouse to stock grains and cereals before coming to Paris. It has been built in the 30s. So it's an industrial building, totally in concrete. It's 20,000 square meters. So it's a really big building, totally in concrete. And we made a reconversion of this building, but really with the will to really let it in its original feature and keep this concrete and keep these lines and keep this industrial shape. The advertising agency BETC has its offices in the old building from the first floor.
And then on the ground floor, we really wanted to keep this porosity, this interaction between the building and the city and the territory and the area, because we really wanted to be part of the development of the area and of the animation of the area. So we let a big, big space of 800 square meters to do a cultural and creative programming. So we do some our own production of cultural programming, and also we can welcome some production and some programs. And then we have two places, coffees and restaurants, that can welcome the public. So the idea is really to be a kind of totem and natural place for the people of Pantin and of the Seine-Saint-Denis region and of this eastern side of Paris, but also to be a cultural destination into the greater Paris and to really welcome people from the region, but also from all the big area of the greater Paris.
It's interesting there that you mention all these activities and the way that the building itself, it's built towards the community and that idea of community engagement. I know that you mentioned some of the activities there. And during the World Cup, we even had a football pitch and some viewing screens outside. Is that the sort of thing that makes it clear for your neighbors that this is a place for everyone?
Yeah, totally. Everything we've done for the World Cup was part of a cultural programming. So we developed an exhibition and a festival called Par Amour du Jeu 1998 to 2018. And we wanted to develop not only a cultural exhibition on football, but also to really create a big event for everyone, not only the people coming just for the arts, but also all the people from the territory around football. So we had on the ground floor a big exhibition of 38 artists coming from all over the world who worked on the thematic of football between 98, which is a big date in France because it was the last time we won the World Cup, and 2018, which is luckily the new date for the new victory at the World Cup. And we really showed this work of artists on football, but actually because football is such a good pop cultural theme, it was a way for the artists also to raise a lot of social topics such as racism, the place of the women in football, the hooligans, a lot of topics that football helps to raise because it's a really pop cultural theme. So we really had this mix of people, which was really our objective, and we didn't know if we would succeed. But this objective of really mixing people, people coming because of the art exhibition and people coming through football. And this was one of actually the thing we are proud of, and we really want to pursue in this really consistent way of doing our programmation, really attracting different kinds of public and speaking to not only cultural lovers or art lovers, but also to the territory.
That was Eugénie Lefebvre, the director of Magasins Généraux. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Remember to join us next week as we continue to unpack our brand new book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities. You can grab your own copy at any good bookstore or, of course, at monocle.com. The show was produced by myself and edited by David Stevens, and I'm Carlotta Ribello standing in for Andrew Tuck. Don't worry, he'll be back next week. Now, to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Dolly Parton with 9 to 5. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. Working.